How did the universe begin? And how has it changed and evolved over time? How will it change in the future? These are the questions of cosmology. And before about a century or so ago, science had nothing to say about these questions. Not a thing. Biologists and geologists had both made great progress in understanding how life on Earth and the Earth itself had changed over time, but physicists and astronomers didn't have a clue about how or even if the universe as a whole might be changing. And the question of how our universe might have begun was a topic that was only discussed by philosophers and theologians. Scientists at the time had nothing of value to add. Today, less than 100 years later, cosmology is a major branch of physics and astronomy. There are literally thousands of scientists who focus the research in this area. So what triggered this change? Well, most scientific advances take place gradually. A little information here, a little there, and after a while, you have real progress. But in the case of the science of cosmology, everything started and took off very suddenly. The year was 1917, and although we didn't really know it yet, Albert Einstein was about to start us down the road to understanding what we would call the Big Bang. In this lecture, we're going to talk about Einstein and his contributions to the science of cosmology. We'll talk about how Einstein used his general theory of relativity to ask questions about the universe as a whole and how the universe might be evolving. We'll see what Einstein got right in his groundbreaking 1917 paper, and perhaps surprisingly, we'll talk about what he got wrong. And we'll also examine the impact that Einstein's work has on the modern field of cosmology. But before jumping right into Einstein's work in cosmology, I want to take a moment to review some things I talked about in Lecture 2, the lecture on Einstein's theory of general relativity. General relativity is a theory of gravity, and it improved upon and replaced the long-standing Newtonian theory of gravity. And like Newtonian gravity, you can use the equations of general relativity to predict how an object, like a rocket or a planet or a baseball, will move through space. Now, in most cases, Einstein's general theory of relativity made the same, or almost exactly the same, predictions as the Newtonian theory did. But it gets things like Mercury's orbit right, where Newtonian physics fails. General relativity also behaves very differently from the Newtonian theory in circumstances in which gravity is very strong, such as near a neutron star or near a black hole. Conceptually speaking, Einstein's theory is very different from the Newtonian picture of gravity. Instead of being a theory of an attractive force between massive bodies, general relativity is a theory of geometry. According to Einstein, the geometry of space and time is determined by the surrounding distribution of matter and energy. And the phenomena that we associate with gravity is really just the consequence of that geometry. Now, I know that what I've just said is a mouthful, so let's take a step back and look at this idea a little more closely. Far away from any massive bodies, space and time is what is called flat, or Euclidean. Flat space is the kind of space that you learn about in high school geometry. In flat space, the standard geometrical rules apply. For example, the three angles of any triangle will always add up to 180 degrees in flat space. And if we follow any pair of parallel lines, they'll remain parallel forever in flat space. They'll never converge, and they'll never move apart from each other, no matter how long you follow them. But according to Einstein, when you get close to something with a lot of mass or a lot of energy, like the sun or Earth, the geometry of space gets deformed or warped. In these situations, space isn't flat, but can instead be either positively or negatively curved. To understand what I mean by a positively curved space, picture the surface of the Earth. At the equator, any two lines of longitude are parallel to one another, both pointing exactly northward and southward. But if you follow these two lines north, they eventually converge and meet at the North Pole. In flat space, parallel lines will never cross each other. But in a curved space, like on the surface of the Earth, they can and do. Next, picture a triangle with one side extending along the equator and the two other sides extending from the equator up to the North Pole. The two vertices of this triangle that are located along the equator each have angles of exactly 90 degrees. So the sum of these three angles has to be greater than 180 degrees. So once again, we find that the surface of the Earth doesn't follow the rules of flat space. Instead, it's a curved space. The geometry of space, the way that it's shaped, determines how objects move through it. The trajectories of objects follow what are called geodesics. A geodesic is just a name for the shortest possible route between two points in space and time. In flat space, the shortest route between point A and point B is just a straight line. When space and time are curved, however, geodesics aren't straight. Instead, they can be arcs or other trajectories through space. According to Einstein, the Earth doesn't move in an orbit around the Sun because of an attractive force of gravity, but instead the mass of the Sun has warped the geometry of space throughout the solar system, and the Earth is simply moving along a geodesic through this curved space. From this perspective, gravity really isn't a force at all. Instead, it's the direct consequence of the geometry of space and time. Like I said before, in most cases, Einstein's theory predicts that all objects will move in almost exactly the same way that Newtonian gravity says they should. This is good news, since Newton's theory predicts so many things so well. We've seen, however, that Einstein's theory predicts Mercury's orbit correctly, whereas the Newtonian theory gets it slightly wrong. Einstein's theory also predicts that light should be deflected as it passes by massive bodies, and this was shown to be true in observations that were taken during a solar eclipse in 1919. In order to use Einstein's theory to make predictions such as these, one has to find a solution to general relativity's gravitational field equations. Conceptually, these equations relate two things: the distribution of mass and energy in space, and the geometry of space and time. From either one of these two things, you can at least in principle work out what the other has to be. By 1917 or so, only a few solutions to the field equations had been identified. The famous Schwarzschild solution that we talked about in Lecture 3 was the first exact solution to be found. But many other solutions, both exact and approximate, have been found since. It was around this time that Einstein began to think about new and very different applications to his theory. Instead of applying the field equations to the orbit of planets or the deflection of light, he had started to think about the geometry of the universe as a whole. Even for Einstein, this was a very bold and different line of inquiry. To tackle this problem, Einstein put as an input into his field equations a uniform or homogeneous distribution of matter that filled all of space. This, of course, was a simplifying assumption. In reality, the density of matter is higher in some places and lower in others, but it turns out that when you average over large volumes of space, our universe is pretty close to homogeneous, making Einstein's approximation a good one. For example, if I were to count the number of galaxies in two different billion light-year wide regions of space, I would find a very similar number of galaxies in each. And practically speaking, it was this simplifying assumption of homogeneity that made it possible for Einstein to actually find a cosmological solution to his equations. Using his field equations, Einstein worked out what the large-scale geometry of the universe should be. Even more interesting than the geometry itself was the fact that his equations did not predict a static answer. In other words, Einstein's theory seemed to say that the geometry of the universe should be changing with time. But what do I mean when I said that the geometry of the universe should be changing? Well, we tend to imagine space as a fixed background that things move through. But space isn't like that, according to Einstein. The distance between any two points in space doesn't necessarily have to stay the same, but it could increase or decrease as time passes. This is what physicists mean when they say that space is either expanding or contracting. According to Einstein's equations, the universe could be evolving in one of two ways. If the density of matter is high enough, then space should ultimately contract, bringing all points in space closer to one another. On the other hand, if the density of matter is somewhat lower, space should be expanding, and it should continue to expand indefinitely. When Einstein looked at these cosmological consequences of his theory, he didn't like what he saw. For some reason, which I've never personally really understood, Einstein was deeply uncomfortable with the idea of an expanding or contracting universe. Instead, he had a strong philosophical prejudice that our universe should be eternal and unchanging. It just seemed like common sense to Einstein that the universe couldn't be expanding or contracting with time. But Einstein's common sense simply turned out to be wrong in this case. Today, no astronomers think that Einstein was right about this. The fact that our universe is expanding is not remotely in dispute. At the time, however, astronomers really didn't know much at all about the large-scale structure of our universe. They knew that our sun was one of the billions of stars that made up the Milky Way, but it wasn't clear at the time whether the Milky Way was a unique system or whether there were many other galaxies in the universe. Even more important, astronomers hadn't observed anything yet that made it look like our universe was expanding or contracting. Given the limited power of the telescopes and other technologies that were available at the time, it wasn't yet possible to tell that our universe was expanding. As far as the astronomers of the day were concerned, our universe appeared to be static. This helped to strengthen Einstein's belief that the universe was eternal and unchanging. With this in mind, Einstein set out to find a way to make his theory consistent with a universe that was neither expanding nor contracting. To accomplish this, he added into his field equations an entirely new piece, a new term in the equation, which contained what he called the cosmological constant. This new term would act like a repulsive force, preventing the universe from contracting and collapsing in on itself. This cosmological term was an entirely ad hoc addition to Einstein's theory. And even Einstein himself acknowledged that it wasn't justified by anything else we knew about gravity. But that being said, the inclusion of this term was allowed by the mathematics and seemed to make a static universe possible. And at the time, that was good enough for Einstein. So in 1917, Einstein published a paper with the title Cosmological Considerations in the General Theory of Relativity. In this paper, Einstein described a universe that he argued followed from his theory of gravity. This universe soon became known among other physicists as Einstein's world. So what was Einstein's world like? Well, first of all, aided by the inclusion of his cosmological term, Einstein's world was static. It didn't expand or contract with time. Second, the geometry of Einstein's world wasn't flat. Instead, it was positively curved. So in the universe that was being described by Einstein, parallel lines would eventually converge, and the angles of very large triangles would add up to more than 180 degrees. Third, the volume of his universe was finite, but didn't have any boundaries. In other words, if you move far enough in one direction, you would ultimately come back to exactly where you started. The universe wraps around on itself. It's like moving westward along the equator until you circumvent the entire Earth, finding yourself exactly where you started. Cosmologists call a universe with this kind of property a closed universe. In the case of Einstein's world, it would require a journey of a few hundred million light years to circumvent the universe, or about 10 to the 22 miles. Now, over the years that followed Einstein's 1917 paper, a number of other scientists began to use the theory of general relativity to ask these kinds of cosmological questions. One of these was the Dutch astronomer Willem de Sitter, who published a cosmological solution that was really quite different from that of Einstein's. De Sitter's universe, however, didn't contain any matter, so it doesn't really resemble the world that we actually live in. A few years later, a more realistic solution was found by the Russian physicist Alexander Friedman. In many ways, Friedman and Einstein both started from similar initial assumptions. Like Einstein, Friedman assumed that the universe was uniform in density, and he even included a term with a cosmological constant in his calculations. Unlike Einstein, however, Friedman allowed for the possibility that the geometry of the universe might change with time. In fact, Friedman found that it was inevitable that the universe should be either expanding or contracting. Regardless of how Einstein preferred the universe to be, Friedman and others were beginning to show that the theory of general relativity did not allow for the possibility of a static or unchanging universe. When Einstein first heard about Friedman's work, he was sure that the results must be wrong. Friedman must have made some mistake somewhere in his calculations. A little later, however, Einstein began to back off, conceding that Friedman's math seemed to be correct, but still insisting that the expanding or contracting solutions weren't physically possible. With the benefit of hindsight, we can look back and see that Einstein was wrong about this, and that Friedman was right. For one thing, Einstein's solution was unstable. In this sense, Einstein's static universe was like a pencil, perfectly balanced on its tip. In theory, the pencil might be able to stay upright forever, but in practice, any stray air molecule could tip it over at any time. In the same way, if our universe was like the one Einstein envisioned, then sooner or later, the places in the universe with the most matter would slowly start to collapse. And those places with the least matter would start to expand. Because our universe is not perfectly homogeneous, it can't really be static. But at the time, only a few scientists were able to sort this out and understand the situation correctly. To the larger scientific community, it was not yet clear who was right. In the history of science, most debates aren't settled by theory or by mathematical reasoning, but instead by data and observation. And this case was no exception. In the years that immediately followed Einstein's 1917 paper, astronomers were learning a lot about the universe. As I mentioned before, astronomers at the time were still debating whether the Milky Way was unique or whether there were instead many galaxies distributed throughout the universe. By this time, astronomers had actually observed quite a few galaxies with their telescopes, but they weren't really sure what they were looking at. The problem was that they couldn't tell whether these objects, which they called nebulae, were really very big and distant galaxies located well beyond the boundaries of the Milky Way, or instead were much smaller and relatively nearby clouds of gas. You just couldn't tell from the images that they were seeing in their telescopes. To understand this, consider our own solar system. From our perspective here on Earth, the Sun and the Moon appear to be about the same size in the sky, about half a degree across. In fact, the Sun is much, much larger than the Moon, about 65 million times larger by volume. But you wouldn't know that from the images alone. For this reason, if astronomers were to find out what a given nebula really was, they would need a way to measure the distance to that nebula. In the early 1920s, astronomers discovered a new technique for determining distances. This technique made use of a special class of pulsating stars, known as Cepheid variables. It had been known for a decade or so that there was a relationship between the luminosity of these stars and the rate at which they pulsated. The Cepheids that pulsate the most slowly are also the most bright, while the more rapidly pulsating Cepheids are more dim. This relationship made it possible for astronomers to figure out how far away from us a given Cepheid star was. For the first generation of observational cosmologists, this was a crucial and game-changing tool. And speaking of tools, telescopes are also becoming bigger and more powerful during this period of time. In 1919, the biggest telescope in the world was the brand new Hooker telescope, which was located at the Mount Wilson Observatory outside of Los Angeles. It was this telescope that Edwin Hubble used to carry out his pioneering work in observational cosmology. Using this telescope, Hubble identified Cepheids within many different nebulae, and he used them to determine the distances to these objects. Using the Cepheids he found in the Andromeda Nebula, for example, he determined that the system was located about 900,000 light years away, well beyond the limits of the Milky Way. This showed for the first time that Andromeda was not some nearby cloud of gas, but was instead an entirely new galaxy, similar in size and form to the Milky Way. Because of Hubble's discovery, what had previously been known as the Andromeda Nebula, we now call the Andromeda Galaxy. Within a few years, this debate had been ended once and for all. The Milky Way is, in fact, one island of stars in a much larger universe, containing many, many other such islands. Modern estimates are that there are more than 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe. Now, this discovery of Hubble's was amazing, but up to this point, nothing about Hubble's work told us whether the universe was expanding or contracting, or remaining the same as Einstein would have preferred. Even as Hubble continued his work measuring and cataloging the distances to more and more galaxies, this alone couldn't provide an answer to this question. To determine whether our universe was expanding or contracting, astronomers needed to know how those galaxies were moving. If the universe is contracting, Hubble's galaxies should all be moving toward us. On the other hand, if the universe is expanding, these galaxies should all be moving away or receding, being carried away by the stretching of space itself. Over the previous decade or so, an American astronomer named Vesto Slipher, working at the Lowell Observatory near Flagstaff, Arizona, had been measuring the velocities of galaxies. He did this by taking advantage of one of the predictions of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Much like the pitch of a sound gets shifted by the Doppler effect when its source is moving toward or away from you, Einstein predicted that the frequency of light from a source will be shifted if that source is in motion. Slipher observed that the light from many galaxies appeared to be shifted toward lower frequencies, or redshifted. According to general relativity, this redshifting indicated that these galaxies were moving away from us. In 1929, Hubble and his colleague Milton Humason combined their distance measurements with Slipher's velocity measurements for a collection of 46 different galaxies. What they found was one of the most important discoveries in the history of science. First of all, nearly all of these galaxies are moving away from us, or receding. Even more interesting was the fact that their velocities are roughly proportional to their distance away from us. This relationship is now known as Hubble's law. While Hubble's most distant galaxies are zipping away from us at speeds of around 1,000 kilometers per second, more nearby galaxies are moving much more slowly. And although Hubble himself wasn't sure how to interpret this strange result, it turns out that he had discovered the first evidence that our universe is expanding. For many of us even today, the idea of expanding space can be hard to comprehend. Try to wrap our heads around this idea, so let's consider an analogy. Imagine that you're standing on the surface of the Earth. Now imagine that the Earth is expanding like an inflating balloon. As the balloon-like Earth expands, the distance between any two points on the Earth's surface grows. For example, the distance between Chicago and Detroit is 240 miles as the crow flies. But if the Earth gradually expands to twice its original radius over a period of, say, an hour, the Chicago-Detroit distance will increase from 240 to 480 miles over that hour. So from the perspective of someone in Chicago, Detroit would appear to be moving away from us at a speed of 240 miles per hour. Now, if the same observer in Chicago were to look toward New York City, they would find that it's also receding. But because it's about three times farther away than Detroit is, New York will be moving away from Chicago about three times more quickly, or about 710 miles per hour. So as the Earth expands, every city on Earth moves away from every other at a speed proportional to their distance. This is just like the relationship Hubble found for galaxies. Now, there's actually a second aspect of expanding space that this analogy can help us to understand. From any location on the expanding Earth, all cities are moving away from you. Just like there is no center of the surface of the Earth, there is no center of the universe. Any observer located anywhere in the universe would have observed the same recession of galaxies that Hubble discovered. Okay, so space is expanding. But what is it expanding into? This is a question that I get asked a lot. And the answer to this question is simpler than it might at first appear. The fact is that space is not expanding into anything at all. If there were something that space could be expanding into, ask yourself what we would call that thing. Well, we'd call it space. When cosmologists talk about expanding space, they aren't talking about galaxies or some other objects moving into some previously unoccupied space. Instead, they're talking about the space itself becoming larger with time. Around 1930 or so, 13 years after his original paper in cosmology, Einstein finally conceded that the universe did not appear to be static, and he withdrew his ad hoc cosmological constant from his field equations. In the following year, Einstein made a visit to the Mount Wilson Observatory, where he met with scientists including Hubble. Even though Einstein had once held a strong prejudice against the possibility of an expanding universe, he was first and foremost a scientist. And when the empirical evidence disagrees with the beliefs of a scientist, that scientist changes their beliefs. Albeit reluctantly, Einstein conceded that our universe is expanding. Perhaps most frustrating to Einstein was that he knew that if he had been a little more confident in his own theory and perhaps a little more open-minded, he could have predicted that the universe would be expanding or contracting. By insisting that the universe must be static, he missed the opportunity to predict one of the most important scientific discoveries of all time. According to Einstein's friend and colleague George Gamow, Einstein called this the biggest blunder he ever made in his life. Over the decades that followed the work of Einstein, Hubble, and others, the science of cosmology flourished. Today, it's a rich and vibrant area of inquiry. Over the course of the 20th century, the observations made by cosmologists came to increasingly support what we now call the Big Bang theory. The idea behind the Big Bang basically goes like this. As the universe expands and space gets bigger, the matter in it gets diluted. This means that in the future, the density of the universe will be lower than it is today, and that in the past, it was higher than it is now. This also means that the universe was hotter in the past. If we go back far enough in time, we would eventually find a period in which the entire universe was filled with an ultra-hot soup of matter and radiation, all at temperatures of thousands of degrees or higher, so hot that even atoms themselves couldn't stay intact. These are the kinds of conditions that today you would find inside of a star. This hot era in our universe's early history is what cosmologists now call the Big Bang. This Big Bang theory makes many testable predictions, including that of a background of microwave radiation that should have been generated as the universe expanded and cooled. And today, this background fills all of space. This cosmic microwave background was first detected in 1964, and has been measured at greater and greater precision ever since. As this and other evidence accumulated in support of the Big Bang, more and more scientists became convinced of the validity of this theory. Today, there is essentially universal agreement among scientists that our universe evolved from a hot state over a period of about 13.8 billion years. As I see it, it was Einstein, about a century ago, who first started us down this road. Although sometimes a reluctant one, Einstein was really the first cosmologist. In the next lecture, we'll pick up here, where we left off, and continue with the topic of cosmology. We'll talk about some of the many observations that have confirmed that our universe really did emerge over billions of years from a hot and dense state that we call the Big Bang. And we'll talk about a surprising discovery that was made in the 1990s. This discovery has forced cosmologists to reintroduce into the gravitational field equations of general relativity something that is very similar to the old cosmological constant that Einstein had once included and then later discarded in an effort to avoid the expansion or contraction of space. In its new form, however, this cosmological constant doesn't prevent space from expanding or contracting. Instead, it causes the expansion of space to steadily accelerate, pulling the universe apart faster and faster with time.